speaking from Isaiah chapter 40. It starts at verse 9, and for those of you who are using the church Bibles, it's on page 687. Isaiah chapter 40, starting verse 9 to 17, and then verses 25 to the end. You who bring good news to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You who bring good news to Jerusalem, lift up your voice with a shout. Lift it up, do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes in power, and he rules with a mighty arm. See, his reward is with him, and his recompense accompanies him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. He gently leads those who have young. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in the basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? Who can fathom the spirit of the Lord or instruct the Lord as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They're regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offering. Before him, all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. And then moving on to verse 25. To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal? Says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls forth each of them by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths go tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint.
Thank you, Bob.
Let's pray together. Father, I just want to pray blessing on James as he opens up your word today. To speak through him in power, Father, and bring your word alive into our hearts that will bring us to a new place and a new experience of you. Bless him, I pray, Father, in your name. Amen.
Amen. Morning. You hearing me all right? Good. Tim, our pastor here, asked me to preach on the fourth I Am statement of Jesus in John 10. I didn't ask him why he thought that it would be appropriate for me to preach from that one. But I guess it might have something to do with its being about livestock. And, well, many years ago as a student, I did two separate months, a year apart, a lambing job. And I decided then that sheep weren't for me. I've thought many times since that probably dairy cows aren't for me either. But I know little about sheep. I know quite a lot about dairy cows. But I couldn't say, to paraphrase Jesus, that I was a good stockman. There's been times when cows, and more particularly, I can think of one bull in particular, that wanted to kill me. But I've never contemplated dying for the livestock in my care. King David, as a shepherd, when he was a shepherd, a literal shepherd, did, when he tells about confronting a lion and a bear and taking a lamb out of the lion's mouth. That was putting your flock before your own life. And if we read that part of John 10, it says, "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But a hireling, he who is not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he is a hireling and does not care about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my sheep, and I'm known by my own. As the Father knows me, even so I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep." It got me thinking. People refer to a church as a flock. And it got me thinking that we employ a pastor or a shepherd in this flock. And I thought I'd pose the question. So, would you come up here, Tim?
I think I know the question.
Would you be willing to die for any of us in your flock?
You need an answer now. Well, let me see. There's a few around I might die for, but maybe, yeah, well, I don't know. What a question, James.
It's terrible, isn't it?
What a question.
Yeah.
I'm very sorry. I don't know whether I could really honestly answer it.
That's okay.
You know that I'd do anything for Jesus, but there are some things that I just am not prepared to do.
Yeah. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's all right. I did ask him before. So what did Jesus mean when he said, "I am the good shepherd"? I believe he was making a statement about the personal and collective nature of his care for those who trust him. Most of his listeners either had sheep or knew those who had sheep. They would know what was involved in looking after them. In the Middle East, a shepherd leads the sheep to pasture and to safety. Unlike what we know happens in this country, where a shepherd drives the sheep, using dogs usually, and that's the way they accomplish that task. So it's a different nature of a relationship. And at this point in his ministry, Jesus obviously hadn't died, which probably led to people wondering what he was talking about, which is why they said at the end of the passage, he's mad or has a demon. He's obviously off his head because he doesn't know what he's talking about. We know, those of us who believe in him, that Jesus did die and that he rose from the dead, thus giving us assurance now and expectant hope for our eternal future. So that doesn't mean his shepherd care was only for his followers when he was alive on earth before the resurrection. I am fully persuaded that he does care for you and me now. Our reading in Isaiah 40 gives a beautiful picture of this. I must say I do love this chapter of Isaiah because it has such wonderful contrasts. The 53rd chapter is beautiful in its description of Christ prophetically. But this one contains prophetic promises. We didn't read it all, but it talks about comfort my people, says your God. It's prophetic in the sense that John the Baptist quotes directly from this. And it talks about us being frail, like grass, dying, living, flourishing for a short while, and dying. And it talks about this nature of God as a shepherd. And it says, he will gather them, the lambs, in his arms and carry them in his bosom and gently lead those who are with young. Doug, can you put the picture up? That's the limit of what I do in terms of gathering in my arms. I do occasionally carry them. I can't carry anything older than that. I can lead and guide those who are with young. But this is an ongoing thing. Thanks, Doug. This is an ongoing thing. It's much more than that. And yet he goes straight on to talk about him as the creator. And it's challenging to our follies that we try to limit God in some way. The limits of my conception of who he might be and what he's capable of are the limits of what I think he is. And this chapter is saying, you basically have a notion. I mean, I find it mind-blowing that a mind that could conceive the universe in its complexity, and awe-inspiring, that the more those who study such things study life, even down to the cellular structures that make us up, the people who we are infinitely complex and far beyond most of our understanding as to how it could possibly be. And yet, he's interested in you and me personally. Because it says the nations are like a drop in the bucket. It's almost like the things that you think are big and important, God does that he speaks a word and it happens. He spoke the universe into existence. It's almost like dealing with you and me is the hard work that God has to do. You know, people have made images of God because it talks about them here. They've doubted his existence. They've doubted his power. And for most of us, we've doubted if he really cared personally for me. I wonder how many of us have said words like these, the same words or words very similar to it. God, my world is collapsing around me, and I don't feel, let alone see you in my life. Why should I carry on? Or like the people around the cross who said, come down from the cross, and then we can believe you. We all would love miracles in our life. Do this, God, and I'll believe. I think it was Woody Allen that said, if he puts $1 million in my Swiss bank account, I'll believe him. I'm not sure he would, because I think Tim mentioned it before. It took the Israelites about 3 or 4 days after God had performed amazing wonders and miracles in Egypt before they were saying, "What have you brought us here to die in the desert for?" And they repeatedly questioned God. Why, after performing amazing miracles, even raising the dead, did the Jews 2,000 years after those people in the desert kill the miracle worker Jesus? And going back to those people, the Bible tells us there were only 2 adult males who left Egypt, who went into the land. That's solemn. That's basically saying that the rest, it was 40 years, so, you know, people, there would have been, naturally people die, but every adult male, so that's everyone from the age of 16 or 17, whatever was termed adult in, for the ancient Hebrews, only 2, Caleb and Joshua, were faithful enough to believe God's promises to go into the, to leave it, Egypt, and go into the land. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. It means struggle. And it's what I believe almost all people of faith should expect to do. The difference between believers and unbelievers is that we believe in the shepherd of our souls, as the apostle said, who's been here. He's seen and experienced what human life is like. He saw joy and sorrow, love and hatred, faith and betrayal. And I was watching a YouTube clip of something that I'd been wondering about in the back of my mind, and it was confirmed. Johnny Erickson Tada was talking, who's the quadriplegic from the teenage, was talking about, and this is in America, but I'm sure it's probably creeping in here, the rising number of Christians seriously contemplating euthanasia when things are getting really tough. And she said something that struck me very powerfully. And she said, talked about how she'd ministered to somebody who was contemplating that. And she said, "We seem to remember that the Bible tells us that 1,000 years is as a day for God. So we think, what does a few more days matter? I might as well go." And we forget the other part of that verse that says, a day is as 1,000 years to him as well. Every moment you can bring blessing to somebody is precious to God. There's another aspect of our relationship with Jesus as a shepherd, which I guess I hadn't really appreciated until I started thinking about it. In one sense, you go, yeah, it's obvious. But it didn't really strike me until I thought about it again and thought about it in the relationship to the work that I do. I wonder if I started this talk by saying, you're all a bunch of sheep. I'm fairly certain that many, if not all, would be thinking, who does he think he is? speaking to me that way? And yet, Isaiah 53 says, "All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to our own way." Jacob, we know from the reading Genesis, he was an expert shepherd. You know, he bred his father-in-law's sheep to make sure that he knew what he was doing with sheep. He knew everything about them. And yet it took him 147 years before he says at the end of his life, "The God who shepherded me my whole life through." He wasn't making some warm, comforting statement. He was, but he was also saying, "The God who knew that I was foolish, that I didn't know what I ought to have known, that yes, he cared for me, but yes, he had to adjust me. He had to stop me doing stupid things. He had to teach me that everything that I wanted to do wasn't necessarily his way." I confess, I daily, if not daily, it's every other day, utter these words to animals in my care: "Why are you so stupid?" You'd think I'd realized by now and given up. Either it's true and I shouldn't get upset, or I'm incompetent. I haven't yet, and I currently am confident that God will not give up on me, despite him often feeling the same. Why are you so stupid? And if you don't believe me, just read the prophets. God's crying out frequently, asking, "What do I need to do to make you listen? What do I need to do more for you to love me? I can't force you to. I want you to love me because of who I am." Sometimes, like Jacob, we only see his shepherd care at the end of an event or the end of a life. We may not see it like him in the end of our own lives, but we might see it in the life of somebody else. Or we think that we're just passive. We're just like these lambs being carried about, and there's nothing really for us to do other than we'll carry on and just wait for the Lord to intervene in my life. But think about Peter. Peter was a fisherman, and the first thing Jesus said to him was, "I want to make you a fisher of men." And then his commission was to become a shepherd. So what Jesus was saying to Peter is, "I'm going to shepherd you by you shepherding others." The ministry of Peter still speaks to us alive today. Peter went to glory, nearly 2,000 years ago. But his epistles and the stories of his life still speak to us today of God shepherding him and shepherding us through his words. I'd like to finish this talk with a personal illustration. I might get a bit emotional, but my grandmother was born in 1896. The illegitimate daughter of a farm housemaid and a local fisherman in Lochmaben in southwest Scotland. Her father appeared to have nothing to do with her, and her mother left her as a young child in the care of her sister, my grandmother's aunt. I don't know when she came to faith, but she was a Christian when she married my grandfather in London in 1919. She was told not to marry him because he was in poor health and hadn't passed a military medical, which, as you can imagine, the First World War would have been pretty rare. He did outlive her, remarkably, and she had faith that she was making the right decision. She sent two sons to war who survived, and two daughters who were working away from home in the Second World War, and a husband who was a clerk in the post office for government felt it was right for workers to be away from home so that they experienced a little of what was like for those military service personnel who had to go away. She was left with my father, who was only five at the time, and she said, "I can be the best carer for my son," which I guess, although she never mentioned through her whole life, her earlier life experience, my father didn't know about her birth until after she died. But she went through the Blitz in the East End of London with my father. She was passionate about his education. And I wonder what she thought when he won a scholarship to Oxford to study there, that the illegitimate daughter, with no hope and prospects and abandoned by her mother, should still be able to care and have passion for her child. All her children came to faith. All her surviving grandchildren are people of faith. But where I come into her story is very briefly at the end of her life. Without forethought, I didn't know, but in 1969 she was dying of cancer. And coincidentally, at the same time, my mother thought it a good idea to try and teach her sons the 23rd Psalm. I was 3 and a half, the fourth son, but the only one who was word perfect. I have no recollection of learning it, but I do remember being taken by my father to recite it to my grandmother, and I being moved by it. And I imagine if a 3 and a half year old child recited to me at the end of my life the 23rd Psalm, it would move me too. That even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me. It is with hindsight an anchor point for my soul. God used me to comfort another, even though I didn't really understand that at the time. That's all I have to say. But I trust that you reflect that sometimes when we really want God to shepherd us, he maybe wants us to do it through our care and shepherding of others. And then we see that it's reciprocal. And we see, as I've experienced in this church and in every church I've been in, despite the ups and downs, the people I've experienced, his shepherding of me, both correction and encouragement, through the people around about me. May the Lord bless his word.